Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
This morning, as we think together, picked out a few scriptures that would sort of tend to lead toward restoring our souls. As Moses spoke to the people concerning obedience from the Word of God, Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 9, he says, "Take heed to yourselves and diligently keep yourself." The psalmist in Psalms 4 and verse 1 says, "Hear me when I call on God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer." Then in Psalms 23 and verse 3, it says, "He restores my soul." In Psalms 25 and verse 20, "Keep my soul and deliver me. Let me not be ashamed, for I put my trust in you." In Psalms chapter 116, verses 3 and 4, it says, "The pains of death surround me, and the pangs of Sheol lay hold on me. I found trouble and sorrow. Then I called upon the name of the Lord. O Lord, I implore you, deliver my soul."
I have the privilege this morning of introducing to you our speaker for the morning, Mr. Bill McDonald. He is a graduate of Lipscomb University. He did youth ministry in Centerville, Tennessee for a while after that, until going on to school, going back to school and becoming a funeral director and a mortician with his father. And to this day, he is the owner and operator of McDonald Funeral Homes. Bill is also an elder at the Centerville Church of Christ. And when Aaron and I went to Centerville, Bill was our first contact there, and we got to know him very well in that. And he had a passion for youth ministry. He was one of the guys that I worked with for years in our youth program there, and loved his passion for that. Bill's traveled around all over the United States doing grief workshops over the years. And I've always been convinced if you just listen to someone talk a little bit, you can see where their passion lies. And I can tell you that he is definitely passionate about helping people cope with and understand the grief process. And he's very good at doing that, and that's where his passion lies, and we're thankful for that gift that he has. He's an avid outdoorsman, and to be honest with you, just knowing him as a personal friend, he's one of the most selfless, giving individuals that I've ever known. And we're thankful to have him here with us this morning. So without taking up any more of his time, we'll ask Bill to come speak to us.
Thank you very much, Chris. You read what I wrote for you real well. I appreciate that. I love old people more than you could ever imagine. Just having turned 60 week before last, I hope you love old people too. And the thing that I love about old people is what Moses wrote in the 90th Psalm. The days of our years are 70, and if we're unusually strong, they might be 80 years. Even then, their strength is labor and sorrow, for we are soon cut off and we fly away. But there were two verses later that Moses said these words, "So teach us, O Lord, to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom." I think Moses had begun to figure it out, that life is not as long as we would like it to be. Life is not necessarily as fair as we would want it to be. And the sooner that we can kind of wrap our arms around that, the better off we might be. My mother and my father would argue with me, and they would say life can be too long because the latter years sometimes are filled with labor and sorrow. And even then, we are cut off and we fly away. But I like old people because they've had an opportunity to learn and gain a real heart of wisdom. My mother's father, Paul Boland, died when he was 99 years old. And Paul Boland was as bright and as sharp the day he died as he was the first time I met him, which I don't remember because I was the firstborn grandson in my mom's family, and they were really glad I was there. And they took me early so I could get to know him soon. But Paul Bolin was a sage. And there were a lot of things that Paul Bolin said that over the years made a great deal of sense to me. And I'm going to share a couple of those with you today as we have this conversation about grief. Of all the things that I don't want to have happen today, I don't want anyone to think that I'm trying to tell you what you have to do or need to do or ought to do or should do. What I want to try to share with you today is how it affected me. What I want to share with you today are the hearts of some 6,000 or 8,000 people that one-on-one and in small groups I've had the opportunity to visit with on this subject. Who've opened up their hearts and pulled the doors of their grief room back and let me come sit inside for a while and listen to what they had to say as they tried to struggle their way through this particular portion of their lives. When I said that Paul Bolin was an old sage, he really was, and he said something incredibly deep one time to me when he looked at me and he said, "Bill Mack, you need to remember, son, that sometimes in your life you're going to try to put so many peas on your plate that it can't hold them all. You can only put so many peas in your plate until some of them roll off." From sitting with your elders last week and from talking to Chris and Andrew and some others, these last few months you all have had so many peas that look like grief that have been put in your plate that it's just hard to keep them all in the right place. And the more of that you pile on, the more peas that fall off. And when you begin to pick them up and look at them, it's interesting what you might see in each one of them. Doubt, fears, questioning, a lack of acceptance, an absolute denial, a feeling of disparagement, of being left alone, of being cast aside, a feeling of what's it worth anyway, what good does it do? And today I want us just to kind of have an open conversation about these very things. I just want to peel back a few of the layers of my protective nature, and I want to share with you from my side of the fence what I've seen and felt and learned and thought and heard. This has been going on for a long, long time. If you take a look at some of what was written in the Psalms, you find out very quickly that our buddy David found moments in his life when he felt like all the peas were falling off the plate and he just couldn't keep them all up there anymore. And he wrote these words, "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in deep mire where there is no standing. I have come into deep waters where the floods overflow me. I am weary with my crying. My throat is dry. My eyes fail while I wait for my God." And moving from that passage in Psalm 69 to the 102nd Psalm, a psalm that I interestingly discovered the morning of 9/11. I was on the way to Mars Hill Bible School in Florence, Alabama to give a pep talk to their high school and junior high. As that day, that school had set aside a period of time to celebrate their successes, to really take a look at how good things had been there and all the marvelous things that that group had accomplished and all the successes that had been theirs and all the awards that had come and all the teachers that had been honored and all the athletic prowess that they had shown. And they just invited me in to kind of sit down with them and talk with them about that nature of success. As I came out of a bank board meeting that morning, I ran into Robert Bowman in the hall, and he said, "Go home, turn your TV on, look and see what's happening. A plane has hit one of the Twin Towers, And I took off and went home just across the street and sat down and turned the tube on because I had about 20 minutes before I had to leave to go down there. And while I'm sitting there watching TV, there's a shadow that appears on the left-hand side of the screen. And the next thing you know, a second plane has struck the opposite Twin Tower. And everyone knew that we were under attack. And I sat there and watched as that place burned. And I'm driving down this road going to speak to these children, and I realize that from this moment on, their lives will never, ever be the same again. That the innocence of their experience has all of a sudden been taken away from them. And they're going to have to relook and rethink about everything, and their growing up wouldn't be like my growing up. And I'm driving down the road thinking, what am I going to say to them? And driving down the Natchez Trace Parkway, I'm driving about 40 miles an hour and flipping through my Bible and just taking a glance at passages that I thought might be encouraging. And for some reason or another, I turned here to look at Psalm 101, and I glanced at Psalm 102, and I saw these words, "Hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come to you. Do not hide your face from me in the day of my trouble. Incline your ear to me. In the day I call, answer me speedily." And I want you to listen to these words that he writes, and I want you to think back to that day as you remember it, what you saw and what you felt and what you heard. "For my days are consumed like smoke. My bones are burned like a hearth. My heart is stricken and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. Because of the sound of my groaning, my bones cling to my skin. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. I lie awake and am like a sparrow alone on the housetop. My enemies reproach me all day long, and those who deride me swear an oath against me. For I have eaten ashes like bread and mingled my drink with weeping." And every picture of what I had seen on the television screen that morning flashed before me in the reading of these words, because I was a broken and wounded spirit in that hour, just as you were, and just as this last few weeks have left you. I love elderships who care. And I appreciate your eldership more than I could ever tell you, inviting me to come be with you today so that we can talk about two or three different parts of this thing that we call grief. And in this hour, there were two questions that I wanted to share with you, because these were the two questions that were in my mind more than anything else, beginning the morning that my brother died and the next 3 years that I struggled through that. I was 16, he was 13. Death came suddenly one morning as he was curled up in the bed sleeping. My younger brother and I got out of our room, went through his room, grabbed him by the leg, drug him out of the bed, threw a shirt to him and said, "Put your shirt on, man. We're going fishing soon as breakfast is over." You never left before you ate breakfast at my mama's house. It was the best meal of the day. I'll bet you the largest dump truck here in Columbia couldn't hold the oatmeal that my mama fixed for me. And I guarantee you that two-thirds of it was butter and sugar. It was absolutely wonderful. So my younger brother and I went on down the hall, went in the den, turned on the TV, stretched out on the floor. We always sat on the floor with our backs against the couch. And we were watching television. I remember what was on when Dad came upstairs, because Mom had called Dad and told him to come up from downstairs and eat breakfast. Everything was ready. And when he came through the door, I remember my mother hollering down the hall, "Mac, go on and get Ken up. He's not awake yet." And Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner, were on the screen right then. And Dad left the hall, the room, and walked up the hall and stopped just outside the door. Mom was in the kitchen. We were in the den. And Dad said these three words, "Ken is dead." No preamble, no words of introduction, just a statement of the stark reality that would turn our family upside down. Ken is dead. And I remember jumping up and running fastest down the hall, and I got to the door and I turned the corner and I looked in, and there he was. No longer rosy-cheeked, but ashen gray, changing the color of his lips. My younger brother came running in and stopped just inside the door, and Mother came running in between two of us, both of us, and jumped up on the bed and just picked my little brother up in his arms, and I am standing there in disbelief, and nobody is saying anything. And all of a sudden, there's this swelling up inside of me. And I turned and went walking down the hall. And in the hallway, there in the apartment above the funeral home where we lived, in the hallway was a table. And that's where we all came in from church and lay our Bibles when we were home. And you could find Mom's and Dad's and Bob's and Ken's and mine always on that table. And I went by and I picked up a little New Testament that the youth group at the South Fulton, Kentucky had given me the first time I ever spoke out of Centerville as a thank you for coming. And I picked up that little Bible that was given to me at 14, almost 15, and I rolled it up in my hand, and I walked out the back door of the house, and I crawled up on the flat roof that's actually over the casket selection room, and I made it around to the corner of the house where the air conditioning unit was. It went on up on the top of the funeral home building, and I crawled up on the air conditioning unit, and I jumped up on the ledge, and I caught, and I pulled myself up, and I went to the place I used to go play when I was a kid. I don't know if Mom and Dad ever knew I was running around on the roof or not. Didn't make any difference. It was a marvelous place to go. There were three big maple trees that set out front of the funeral home, and this was the porch area that kind of went over the entrance to the funeral home and the first room. And the big maple trees just made a wall, and it was just the sky and the roof. And I loved to go up there in the summertime when it was raining and just lay in the valley of the roof and let that warm water run over me. It was a wonderful place for a kid to go. It's where I kept my cigar box. You know, that's what you put all your neat stuff in. And I kept it in the crook of the downspout of the gutter. And it had the neatest things, you know, frogs that had been run over and dried off the road, and dead spiders and worms and squiggly, rubbery things, and just all kind of stuff that I just loved. I kept them in that box. I hadn't been up there in several years, but all of a sudden, in that moment of time, I needed and wanted to be somewhere safe. And that's where I remembered feeling the safest when I was a child, and that's where I went. But what happened when I got there was the thing that amazed me most. Because I curled up my Bible in my left hand and I held it behind my back and I made a fist with my right hand. And looking up above those maple trees in that blue sky, I shook a very angry fist. And I said these words, Why? Who do you think you are?" And God and I were really having a very major conversation in my 16-year-old life, because I could not figure out what sense it made for a sweet 13-year-old boy who never did anything but help other people. I could not figure out how that fit in my comprehension of what life was supposed to be. And I struggle with that. You know what I actually was afraid of when I finally got it out of my system? I expected any minute, "I'll teach you." And I went 3 years wondering what was going to happen when he and I had that great conversation in the sky, because of the way that I had felt and the anger that had filled me in that moment of time and the hurt and the questions that followed. And I wallowed with that a long, long time. And then as a freshman at Lipscomb, I was sitting in McFarland Hall over in the science building. Some of you have been there and done that. In my freshman Bible class, with a teacher that had a minimal amount of influence in my life, some guy named Dr. McWayne Craig, was sitting there in that class, and I certainly say that tongue in cheek. And I'm sitting there in that class. We're in the last week. He has divided 153 people into seven sections. We were the top right-hand section. And he went from section to section to section to section to section to section, giving us an assignment, because where we were standing there looking at Christ on the cross. And I don't know if you ever heard Dean Craig talk about that, but it was amazing. And he said, what we're going to do in the next couple of days is simply this. We're going to take the seven things that Christ is recorded as saying while he was hanging on the cross, and we're going to take a deep and sincere look at those words. And he said, what I'm going to do is assign each one of you seven sections, one of those sayings, and I want you to study it and read it and think about it. But most of all, and I'll never forget these words, I want you to hear something in that phrase that's assigned to you that you have never, ever heard before. And then when we get in class and we get to your section, I'm going to call on two of you to share your thoughts on that. Have you ever had one of those feelings where you knew that he was going to call on you? And it's always when you don't know what in the world the answer to the question is. So I go home that night into the room with my best buddy Bobby Morrison. Monk studies always early. I'm studying all afternoon, late into the evening. At 11:30, I'm still thinking, what am I going to say? I've been talking about that since I was the very first time I spoke in South Fulton, Kentucky, since I was 14. But what can there possibly be new about what he has given me? Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Over and over and over those words. My God, why have you forsaken me? And it was just like somebody had pulled a curtain out of the window and let me look outside from a period 3 years earlier in my life almost. And instead of seeing Christ going, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? In my mind's eye, I could see a 16-year-old boy with a Bible curled up behind him and a fist in the other hand, shaking that fist at the sky and saying, why, who do you think you are? And in that moment of Christ's life, when I see him as more human than at any other time in his life, he spoke volumes to me about what I had felt in that moment of time. Because I had felt abandoned. I had felt turned away. I had felt forsaken. I had felt mistreated. And all I could ask was, where are you? Why have you forsaken me and left me alone? And when I read those words of Christ and realized that there was an exclamation point, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, there was a part of me that said, Bill Mack, if the Son of God felt that way and expressed it, in the moment that He did, He gave you permission to feel the same way and say the same things. Because that began the cleansing of my heart from the fear and the judgment that I felt was coming and the disappointment that I had been to God. Because if Christ learned obedience by the things which He suffered, perhaps that might be what was in store for me. That what I was going through was a learning experience. The second big question that came out of all that is this. One of my favorite verses in the Bible at that time was Romans 8:28. All things work together for good to those who love the Lord and to those who are called according to His purpose. I found not a semblance of truth in those words for a number of years. Because I could make no sense out of why a sweet, kind, wonderful, giving mama's boy at 13 should be taken out of the midst of his family. But I especially couldn't figure out why that was supposed to work for good in my life. And it went on a few years. And I began working with families when I got back home, and I found out that having a funeral and walking with them through that part and even helping them at the service if they needed somebody to speak and then sending them home just wasn't enough sometimes. But there were people who hurt. And the more I was around those people who hurt, the more I wanted to get out of what I was doing because it rekindled those feelings and emotions that I'd had years ago. And there had to be something come out of that. And that's when I decided that what that verse meant was this. All things can work together for good to those who love the Lord and to those who are called according to His purpose. And the purpose in my life then became doing what I could do to help folks who felt like I had felt. And if I could have Ken back today, I would choose that over than being here with you. But since I can't, this is the purpose Ken's death has been in my life. And that is to share with you my feeling of brokenness, but to be able to listen with an open ear to those whose hearts are broken in order that I might hear what they have to say and not be judgmental about what they have to say. And therein began my struggle of healing. But here's the biggest one of the bunch. The biggest one of the bunch is simply this. The why part never got answered. I got permission to say that, and I figured out a way to take what had happened and make that work in a way that maybe some other people could benefit by the struggle that I had had and could learn from what other people have taught me about living inside of a grief room and the parts of that room that they are. That there are, and what people have taught me about successfully moving through losses that I can't understand how anybody could move through. People like Dorothy Bright, and her last name is perfect. 6 children, 4 sons, 2 twins born early, 1 died 4 days after childbirth, the other one died at 19 in an accident that he had nothing to do with. 4 boys and 2 girls. The 3rd boy died in an accident at 21 that he had nothing to do with. And the 4th boy died at 23 from an accident that he had nothing to do with. And she was still the brightest stick of wood in the fire. Because she had been able to put all of that in its place and had been able to take her life and continue to bless other people with it. People like Dorothy Bryant have taught me how much we can actually bear if the time comes. And the last thing that I have just struggled and struggled and struggled with is not really understanding why. And it wasn't until one time, again, I was reading. And actually, I was getting ready to do a wedding for a friend of mine. And I had turned to 1 Corinthians 13. And I had read all that marvelous stuff about love. How special love is. How giving love is. How completing love is. How whole love is. And then I got to begin reading down in about verse 8. Where it says, love never fails you. But where there are prophecies, they will fail. Where there are tongues, they will cease. Where there is knowledge, it will vanish away. And then verse 9 began to open my eyes to something that I finally just had to accept. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror very dimly, but then face to face. Now I know only in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. Those verses rang a bell with me for the first time that I had never, ever heard. Paul is just saying to the church at Corinth, some of these things that have been your trials, you're not going to ever understand. You'll never be able to put them in the right place. You'll never be able to figure out why they make sense. You'll never, ever, on this side of eternity, be able to see things as you want to see them, because we are looking through a dim glass and only getting a glimmer of what's on the other side. Only a glimmer of what's on the other side. My mom was quite an incredible lady. When she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, the doctor came in and began telling her what they were going to do to try to fix it. And Mom looked at him and said, no, we're not. You and I both know from what you've described and where the growth is located that this is not going to help. It may give me another month or two or three, but it'll give me 5 or 6 months of sickness trying to get over it. You and I know I've got 6, maybe 7 months left. And we're not going to do any of that. I'm going to go home and have the best time that I can have between now and then. And she said, you know, you got to remember, Doc, I've got a 13-year-old boy that I haven't seen in 38 years. And I have a man who loved me for 51 years that I haven't seen in 11. And I'm just ready to slip over there rather than go through everything that I'm going to have to go through here. Mom's life was done. For my mother, her life was finished. My mother's life was complete. Now, I will tell you that she turned to me and she said, don't take this the wrong way, Bill. You're fine. It's just that I've spent a lot of time with you lately, and I'm ready to go on to where I'm headed. And I thought to myself, wonder if I'll ever understand well enough that if the hour comes, I will be able to say that in the way that she was able to say it and mean it. And then I got to thinking back about that passage in 1 Corinthians 13. Bill Mack, just remember, Hoss, there are some things in your life you will never be able to understand. And you're just going to have to trust God to work that out as best it can be. And you're going to have to let go. And you're going to have to let Him take you by the hand and show you where you need to go. And you're going to have to let faith, take you across that valley on a bridge that you just don't see, but that you believe is there. When Mother was getting right down to the last days of her life, she had written her funeral plans out years in advance. She showed them to me one day, and it started out like this: "Bill, I'd just like for you, please, to thank folks for coming and tell them how much we appreciate the help they've been. Then let Paul do his thing, and the sermon will be over with, the funeral will be over with, talking about Paul Rogers, and you can go sit down." I read them another time, and she said, "Bill, Paul is not feeling real well. Maybe you need to kind of do the first part, so he'll only have to stand up long enough to do the longer part." Then there was another mark out and correction that said, "Paul's barely hanging on, but he'll want to say something at my funeral. So if you don't mind, let Paul start, and then you do the major part." And the last entry on that page, and this was years before she died, 4 years before she died, the last entry on that page said, "Paul has died on me, and you're going to have to do it all. And here's what I want you to say." And Mom had written out her funeral service. She was the only person at that time in 2,108 funeral services that I had helped with that did not trust me well enough to use my own discretion at what needed to be said. But she had written it out in its completeness. But Mother was wise with her years. She knew that if I talked from my heart, I'd never get it out. That's the way I'm made. But if I was trying to say what she wanted said, things would be okay. And I found this poem in what she had written. And I want to close with it today. Because here's a lady who had been through so many heartaches with the death of her child, with the trouble that her youngest son had gotten into, which I believe was directly tied to my middle brother's death, to breast cancer, and a whole series of just difficulties. Mother had this poem at the close of her funeral service, and I leave it with you today. It's called "The Weaver." And in Mother's handwriting, she had written this in its place: "My life is but a weaving between my Lord and me. I cannot choose the colors, for He worketh steadily. Oft times He weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget He sees the upper, but I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly shall God unroll the canvas and explain the reason why. The dark threads are needed in the weaver's skillful hand as threads of gold and silver in the pattern of life's plan." There's always a lot of things in your life and mine that will go to that place where we don't understand. And most of all, I don't understand why God would choose His Son to bridge the distance between heaven and hell. I don't know why God would choose the shedding of His Son's blood to get me someplace I could never go without the shedding of that blood. I don't understand why Christ would go through with something He didn't have to finish except for the love that He had for me. That I will never understand, but that is the gift that He gives to each one of us if we'll profess our faith in Him, confess our wrongs to Him, if we'll speak His name, believing in Him, And if we'll let His blood wash us and make us whiter than snow, He'll give us the strength and courage that we need to walk the life that He has set before us. And He will say, when it's all over, no matter what the struggles, you've done well, son. You've been faithful over a few things. I will give you control over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. And let me explain to you why it was so difficult to get here. The invitation of Christ is something you need in any way. The elders will be standing here to meet you. Would you come as we stand and sing?
Rest and room. Come in the strength of manhood. Come in the morn of youth. Enter the fold of safety. Enter the way of truth. Lovingly, tenderly calling is He. Wanderer, wanderer, come unto Me. Patiently waiting there, standing I see, Jesus my Shepherd divine. Jesus the loving Shepherd gave His dear life for thee. Tenderly now He's calling, wanderer, come to Me. Haste, for without is danger. Come, Christ the Shepherd bless. Enter the fold of safety. Enter the place of rest. Lovingly, tenderly calling is He. Wanderer, wanderer, come unto Me. Patiently waiting there, standing I see, Jesus my Shepherd divine.